owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Whether you're listening in on one of our five affiliates or live streaming or podcasting from anywhere around the world, we're very pleased to welcome you to another episode of American Warrior Radio. When you think of a U.S. Marshal, you probably think about Wyatt Earp, Bat Masterson, Bill Tillman, Bass Reeves, one of my favorites, brave men who built a reputation tracking down bad guys in the American West. However, the chronicles of the U.S. Marshal Service go much further back. President George Washington appointed the first 13 U.S. Marshals way back in 1789 after Congress passed the Judiciary Act. They are our nation's first federal law enforcement agency. Their duties are many and varied, from providing judicial security to prisoner operations and transportation. They also play a role in witness security and asset forfeiture operations. Today, we're going to focus a little bit on their role as the federal government's primary agency responsible for fugitive apprehension. Now, Laura and I love to watch true crime programs on television. It never ceases to amaze us how big a role technology plays, from cell phone tracking to DNA analysis, and even those security cameras installed on a neighbor's house or a business pointed at just the right location at the right time. Of course, my favorites are always the bad guys who post a photo of themselves on social media brandishing the very firearm they used to commit a crime. Classic genius. But some things haven't changed since the Bat Masterson days: instincts, courage, and good old-fashioned tracking. Yeah, I'm talking about broken twig or moss scraped off a stone tracking. Those precise skills are one of the subjects featured in a new book released by retired Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal Mark Cameron. Bone Rattle is the latest in Mark's Arliss Cutter series. Mark has also written four novels that are part of the tremendously popular Tom Clancy series, as well as no fewer than 10 novels in the Jericho Quinn series. During his nearly 30-year career with the Marshal Service, his assignments have taken him from Canada to Mexico, Manhattan to Alaska, where he currently resides. Welcome to American Warrior Radio, Mr. Mark Cameron.
Hey, thanks, Ben. Thanks for having me. Appreciate that introduction.
Well, it's a long one, but you've achieved quite a bit.
Well, it's been a fun ride.
Well, folks can learn more. Folks, visit markcameronbooks.com. Mark is spelled M-A-R-C. Now, Mark, just to get things started here, when I had the U.S. Marshal for Arizona on American Warrior Radio, he officially deputized me for a full hour. So I'm bona fide. Feel free to share, you know, any inside tips or anything.
There you go. He probably gave you a little lapel pin or something like that. Yeah, he's a good guy. He's a very good guy. The Marshal Service is small, so we generally, if we don't know one another personally, we certainly know someone that knows them. So.
Okay, well, it was a fun interview, but I'm looking forward to talking to you as well. I'm excited. I read at least one of your books, Bone Rattle. Now, a little bit about you, Mark. You actually began your law enforcement career as a patrol officer. You spent some time as a mounted officer, and I'm not talking motorcycles. I'm talking good old-fashioned horses and a detective. Yeah. What inspired Mark Cameron to make that transition from local to the U.S. Marshal Service?
You know, funny, I used to sit and watch Westerns with my granddad when I was a boy, and, you know, I grew up watching Gunsmoke and, you know, later on watching the True Grit movies, and so I knew what marshals were. And when I was about 15, I grew up went to my high school years in a town called Weatherford, Texas, and where I eventually became a police officer just west of Fort Worth. And I was walking across the town square. It's the county seat. And I was walking across the town square, and this tall guy with a hat on, you know, Stetson on, and his gun showing and his badge clipped to his belt, got out of a pickup and put a little hood over the top of a parking meter, and it said, "Official Business, U.S. Marshal." And for a 15-year-old kid, that was like, well, I want one of those. I don't have to pay for parking meters. And so I started, you know, sort of a goofy beginning to it. But as it turned out, I was friends with that guy's son. And we didn't really even talk about the Marshal Service after that. But I knew who he was. I knew his name because I was friends with his son. And as it turned out, when I eventually got on with the police department, worked a couple of warrants, you know, fugitive ops, helping out the marshals, they would call and say, "Hey, we got this guy located, and you know, go over here and look at this place or whatever, run this down for us." Because it back then it was even smaller than it is today, and it's a relatively small agency in the government anyway. But I was just impressed by the way they didn't care who got the glory. It was a go arrest this guy, and we'll be there as quick as I can, but if he leaves, nab him. And there wasn't any of the stuff you see on the movies about, you know, the feds swooping in and mm-hmm. taking out the glory. Now, I'm super impressed with that.
Mark, that brings up an interesting question, because I think even though the marshals are the oldest federal law enforcement agency, I think they're one of the least understood by the civilian community. And just to use the example you use there, they've got some pretty broad-ranging and flexible authority. For example, on a fugitive task force, when you bring in those local law enforcement officers and they're deputized, that gives them, in effect, extra powers. I mean, they can cross jurisdictional boundaries. They can do a lot more stuff than they normally could, correct?
Yeah, we have statutorily, we have the powers of a sheriff. So we can essentially raise posses. So because of that statutory authority, then, for instance, during the Olympics in Salt Lake City and Atlanta, but I was in the one in Salt Lake City as part of the security detail, Marshal Service personnel came in and deputized as special deputy marshals state and local law enforcement from all over the nation so they could assist in Utah. And that allowed them to, for the period of time, be TFOs or task force agents or special deputies.
So who pays for that? Does the local government pay for that?
No, generally speaking, when most of the time when we talk about a TFO or a task force deputy, that's a way for the federal government to get more bang for their buck. And we convince the locals to come over and help us. We help go with our mission because, again, we're a smaller agency with a large job. And we can say to a police department, hey, we're going to provide the gas for this man or woman's car, their overtime pay. You know, we don't necessarily always pay for their position, but we pay for overtime. And then we also, while we're looking for our quote-unquote bad guys, if you were, our fugitives, we also look for theirs. So when I ran the task force here, we had Anchorage Police, we had ATF, we had an FBI agent that worked with us part-time, we had Alaska State Troopers, and we assisted the locals with their warrants as much as they assisted with the federal warrant.
And I kind of chuckled because it sounds like just the team that was featured in Bone Rattle.
Amazing. Fancy that.
Funny how that works. Mark, we're about to come up on our first break, but I've got to ask you, over that 29 or so years as a law enforcement, was there, I mean, I talked about the lots of different disciplines and roles of the U.S. Marshals. Did you work, how many of those did you work, and did you have a favorite?
I primarily focused on the middle of my career on protection. I was a judicial security inspector, so dignitary protection, but I think everybody likes fugitive work the most, and I really enjoyed that.
Well, and that's a big part of what people will read about in the Arliss Cutter series, I'm guessing. Yet on average, and this is in real life, the U.S. Marshals apprehend an average of 310 fugitives every single day. Ladies and gentlemen, when we come back, we'll be talking more with Mark Cameron. You can learn more, visit markcameronbooks.com. Mark, when we come back, I'd like to talk about some of your books and the inspiration that goes into them. Stick around, folks. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with retired U.S. Marshal Mark Cameron. You can learn more. Visit markcameronbooks.com. Mark is spelled M-A-R-C. Mark, you know, in the tags that we get from your publishers and when we look at the inside covers of your book, we see, you know, the phrase from Manhattan to Alaska. And you chose to settle down there after your career. And I got to tell you, one of the coolest vacations I ever took. We went up to Alaska. We rented a bed and breakfast there in Anchorage and then just sort of did day trips. And I got to say, and you know, my folks are missionaries. I've traveled around quite a bit. But if the world is television, Alaska is television in high definition. I mean,
yeah, you're right.
Everything from the plants to the, you know, if nobody's ever seen a moose up close and personal, they're big animals. You know, not to mention grizzly bears, but we ate crab every night. It was delicious. I mean, it didn't need butter. It was raw.
Yeah.
So
it's a great place to live. I transferred up here, goodness, 23 years ago, and was fortunate enough. I came up here as what we affectionately call a pod, a plain old deputy, no rank or anything, and was fortunate enough to transfer or to promote in place, and eventually became chief. And so we just stayed here. We didn't have to go anywhere else. I spent time in Texas and Idaho with the Marshal Service, but spent the bulk of my career here, and then retired about almost 9 years ago now. And we just stayed here, raised all our children here. Our youngest son's an Anchorage police officer. We just love it here for the reasons you mentioned. I mean, my daughter just got married, and her new husband and I were sitting watching the show in the basement and heard the trash can. They're empty, but the trash cans tump over, and went out and saw a bear, you know, sort of checking everybody's stuff out just a couple of weeks ago. And we have moose in our yard. My wife just got home from the Kenai with 17 red salmon. It's just a wonderful place to live.
Yeah, on that trip, I just have to share, because I'm a big believer in storytelling. We had stopped, at a hotel, and we there was, I don't know what it was, basically a fast food kind of joint. This is one of those just sort of wide spot in the road, and you know, there's a hotel, mm-hmm. and the trucker stopped there and everything. So I went out to get some burgers, and I'm walking back from the fast food joint to my hotel, and got these two bags of big, stinky, smelly burgers, and I hear a noise, and I look up, and here's a bear who had just pulled a bag of trash out of the dumpster. And
that's wonderful.
Yeah, well, for that brief second, he looked at me, and I looked at him, and we kind of had this agreement, okay, you take your food and go that way, I'll take my stinky burgers and go this way, and we'll both
there
be okay. Now, did you start your writing ideas or career when you were still in the service, you know, scribbling notes on the back of a napkin in a seedy Manhattan diner, or did you wait until you retired?
No, I started a long time ago. I told my wife before we even got married, well, first I told her, we met in the theater department in college, and I told her that I wanted to be a drama professor and a novelist. And then right before we got married, I confessed that I really wanted to be a cop. And she married me anyway, and I eventually got on with the Weatherford Police Department, their small department in Texas. And that first year, this would have been in 83, and they weren't providing vests back then. And she bought me a American Body Armor ballistic vest and a Smith Corona typewriter, and just kind of said, go do your thing, pursue this. So I spent about 20 years getting rejection letters in the mail and didn't watch a lot of TV, just wrote every evening in front of my TV time, and got rejection letter after rejection letter, and finally ended up getting a couple of short stories published. And I remember when we finally got money in, because I was expending a lot of time. It was like an illness with me, I think. And I remember my wife, we got like a $700 check. And this was back in the days when, you know, rent was $700, so, or $600. So it was a significant little boon to us. And my wife met me at the door with a rolled-up magazine and sort of swatted me on the butt and said, go write us a couch, you know, go write us a new fridge. And we just kind of kept going from there.
Outstanding. Now, Arliss Cutter of the Arliss Cutter series, is that character based on anyone in particular you might know, maybe? Kind of.
No, I think Arliss is based on a lot of people I know. I was fortunate to work shoulder to shoulder with some just incredible men and women in the Marshal Service and stuff that I wish I knew how to do. And I did. I was fortunate enough to learned some, I grew up as an outdoors person and tracking and, you know, just on my own, but I didn't know the terminology. And when I transferred to Alaska, a good friend of mine, who's also my jiu-jitsu sensei and has been for years, he's an expert tracker. His name's Ty Cunningham. And he had started a tracking unit for the District of Alaska, and the chief at the time, Wanda Phillips, encouraged it. And so several of us went to some tracking schools, and so I base Arliss a little bit on that, a lot about some of the old cowboys I knew, some of the old Texas Rangers I knew, not necessarily in the Marshal Service, but just that archetypal Marty Robbins song, you know, the Arizona Ranger with a big iron on his hip. That's Arliss Cutter.
Now, you know, Ben gets at least one dumb question a show, Mark. I might have more than that today if you'll let me do that. The tracking, and that's one of the things I liked about, because I pretty much grew up in the country myself. I love the tracking aspect of these books. But, you know, it seems to me that makes a lot of sense in Alaska.
Where I was a deputy in East Texas, but the Eastern District, they're divided into judicial districts, but we were north of Dallas up on the Red River, so it Eastern District sort of swoops around, comes up from Beaumont and swoops around to Texarkana, and then up on the northern part of the border above Dallas for a few, like to Denton, I think. So we had a lot of rural country, and so it was not uncommon to go up and check a house for a fugitive and see tracks that led off into the woods. And so you learn to read sign early. And, you know, we have a lot of former military and former Border Patrol in the Marshal Service, and they know some tracking. And so I had some good mentors that helped me early on. And then once I got into the super rural areas, like up along the Canadian border and then into Alaska, it became very necessary. I mean, you have to have it.
I was surprised. We've had the Border Patrol on the show a number of times, and I was surprised when I learned that you know, they teach tracking to them, and it's one of those things where if you think about it half a second, it makes sense. Are there tracking techniques that you would use in Manhattan, though?
Sure. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Tracking, you know, when you think about it, when you boil it all down, the technique of crime scene investigation is tracking. We're looking for evidence on the ground and, you know, in different layers on the ground. It could be a broken twig. It could be, I mean, in its purest function, when an officer walks up to a door and puts his or her hand on the hood of a car to see if it's still warm or cold, that's tracking. When an officer or a deputy is chasing somebody through the woods and you see the person's track and it's filling with water and there's a bear track on top of it, that tells you a whole story, right? Something as simple as knowing and thinking through the way that a person, the physiology, I'll give you a good example. Your listeners can try this. When you're walking with empty hands and you turn and look over your shoulder, you turn and look over your shoulder. And you can tell that from the tracks. When you're walking with a long gun, people tend to turn all the way around and walk backwards for a couple of steps. And then turn back around. They want their gun to go where their eyes are going. It doesn't happen all the time, but boy, if I'm following somebody and they turn around and walk backwards for a couple of steps, I think they may be armed.
Wow, fascinating. Very, very cool stuff. Now, so I tell you, when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about that. One thing I noticed in your book, though, you reference a lot of times specific boots, for example, when you talk about the tracking and the impression that pair of boots leaves, or a certain clothing brand by name. Let me just sort of plant this seed with you, Mark. Will one of your lead characters or even a bad guy in a future novel be listening to an American Warrior Radio podcast?
I'm sure. Absolutely. We'll make that happen.
Shameless.
That's a good idea.
But
good
I'm kind of teasing you, but you actually, your character, Jericho Quinn, there's a custom knife named after him. How did that come about?
Yeah, so I'm good friends with the folks at Three Dog Knife that own Northern Knives here in Alaska, and I spend a lot of time. They have a little cigar bar in the back, and I don't smoke, but I like to sit back there and listen to the operators come in and talk and chat about weapons, and I oftentimes will just go back there and take them a mess of ribs that I've barbecued up and just take notes. And they've just become good friends over the last, almost 20 years. And we talk knives and talk technique and weapons, and a lot of that ends up in the book. And they ended up making a custom, the knife is called a Riot, but they made it a custom Jericho Quinn Riot.
Mark, my grandfather and my father both taught me, you know, measure twice, cut once. Explain Quinn's motto, see one, think two, to our listeners.
When I was a brand new officer, one of my FTOs, we went into a little stop and rob, little store that fast food, or not, a convenience store that we thought was in the process of being robbed, and that was the first thing he taught me. I was probably 3 days on the job. He said, see one, think two. If you see one guy, he's probably got a friend there. And I bought, like I said, I've always been a writer, so I wrote everything down that sounded at all poetic or cool, and see one, think two ended up in one of my early little notebooks. It's a good life lesson.
Mark, when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about sort of that evolution of technology that you've seen over the course of your career. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, chatting with Mark Cameron, best-selling author, former U.S. Marshal. You can learn more at markcameronbooks.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're speaking with former U.S. Marshal Mark Cameron. You can learn more, visit markcameronbooks.com. Now, Mark, I'll tell you, American Warrior Radio listeners are a pretty responsive group. I literally, on the commercial break, got a text from one of them and said, hey, I went and I looked, and, the Quinn knives are all sold out. You better get on that, brother.
Well, they have the riots. They just don't have the ones that have my signature on them and stuff like that. But
so is that what you carry?
Oh, I absolutely. I carry three different kinds of three dog knife. The little riot is kind of my everyday fixed blade, and then when I'm out in the bush, I carry, like, if I'm hunting or filling the freezer, that sort of thing. I carry what they call their Mac, which is a hunting-looking knife. That's what Arliss Cutter carries.
Okay, enough. They're not advertisers, Mark. I guess I better get on that, huh?
Yeah.
So, coming back to Bone Rattle, and it's funny, when I first got the book and I looked at the cover, and knowing that you were a big motorcycle guy, I thought about getting your bones rattled, like and then I found out what the true, the source of the name. But in talking about technology and evolution over time, one of the bad guys who, I'll just use a quotation fingers, as a specialist, he knows that a drip of sweat, a piece of hair that might come off your forearm is a clue. What has been your sense over your career, and what about cell phones now and internet tracking and interagency databases? Has that made the job easier, or is that just my perspective as a guy watching a one-hour show where they go from murder to the bad guys in court in 60 minutes?
Yeah, no, I think it certainly in some respects made the job easier. We do leverage technology, but it depends on where you are. In Alaska, I try to put Cutter in real places where technology is limited. There's still places in fact, the previous book before Bone Rattle takes them out to the western Alaska along the river, where even today there's people that don't have regular flush toilets. They have 5-gallon buckets. They call them honey buckets. Not running water in every house. And is predominant in some of the villages. I'm not talking about a couple of people. So that sort of thing, and interestingly enough, they got cell phones. The local, we have a rule up here, sort of a state law, that one of the providers gives them a cell phone for connectivity for emergencies. I mean, gives them service, not necessarily the phone itself. So it's kind of an interesting dichotomy to be out in the bush. When I say bush Alaska, I mean rural, roadless Alaska, to see some high school kid with a Nokia cell phone and an earpiece riding his four-wheeler to school, And so there is some technology, but at the same time, those same kids are running trap lines and, waiting for the plane to come in. And if the river, the only way you get to these places is by river or air, and in the spring and winter, when the river's kind of frozen but kind of not, you can't take a boat on it, you can't drive on it yet because it's not a winter highway yet because it's not frozen, and if the snow comes in, if the clouds come in, you just can't get there, so they're cut off completely. And if somebody has appendicitis, or as in Cutter's case, there's a homicide and he's out there on something else, you become kind of like one of those mansions in an Agatha Christie novel where everything has to be taken care of on site. You can't rely on anyone to come save you. Be your own rescue.
Mark, talking about old tech to new tech, or maybe not necessarily, Arliss Cutter carries an old-fashioned six-shooter.
Yep.
Was that your normal everyday carry weapon, or?
Yeah, I carried when I started law enforcement, semi-autos were not authorized in the department I was in. Almost everybody carried either a Python or a Smith & Wesson 686. It just kind of was the way of things. In fact, I petitioned and got the data together to give the chief to let us carry in the mid-80s, to let us carry semi-autos, and then didn't have enough money to go buy one. So I ended up still carrying one. And then when I got on with the Marshal Service, we were issued revolvers. I think mine was one of the last two classes that were issued Ruger GP100s. And then right after that, they started carrying semi-autos. But I carried a 44 Special, kind of a dolled-up little round-butt 3-inch barrel 44 Special for a number of years. And then we eventually had to go to Glocks. So now everybody carries a Glock. But as Arliss does, you can carry a backup revolver.
Mm-hmm.
He just happens to carry his grandfather's Colt Python as his quote-unquote backup.
I always am curious about where characters come from, particularly with folks like yourself that have a real-life background that are now writing novels. Your wife and you spend quite a bit of time in the Cook Islands and the Pacific. There's a character in the Arliss Cutter series named Lola Tariki,
yep,
who's of Maori descent. Is this based on someone you met in the South Pacific? It, kind of an unusual pairing for the buddy cop genre.
Sure, certainly inspired by. I wouldn't say she's based on any one person, but we're so fortunate to be able to spend time down there. We go to the island of Rarotonga, which is the biggest island within the Cook Island nation, and it's right in between kind of Fiji, Tahiti, that area. They speak English. They have a delightful Kiwi, New Zealand accent. They use New Zealand money. But we've just got some just dear friends there, and the Maori people are so larger than life. They're a stocky, strong, mm-hmm, type of people anyway, but they live life just so out loud and laughing, and they welcome you. And so Lola is that kind of, she's certainly not an exaggeration. And incidentally, I would say that we have a fairly strong Polynesian population in Anchorage. So it's not somebody in Alaska that reads that there's a Polynesian deputy marshal or a Polynesian Anchorage police officer would not be surprised. We have quite a large population up here.
Mark, I'm curious. You're involved in literally writing three different series all at the same time. How do you keep from the characters or the ideas bleeding over from one or the other, or is that just smart promotion?
No, you know, as far as I was originally just doing the Jerichos and the Cutters, and they're so different. The universes, if you will, are different. The Cutters are, I mean, he rides a motorcycle, he carries a sword stuffed up the back of his motorcycle jacket. He's more of a kick butt, take names kind of a guy. International intrigue, where Arliss is, you know, they're murder mysteries, and I slow down in the Arlisses where there's a lot more character, they're a lot more character driven. And I like both of them, but they're such distinct characters. And then when Mark Graney, who was writing the Tom Clancy, stepped away to pursue his own stuff and pushed my name forward, it was a surprise to me. It came out of the blue. I had no idea. My agent called me. I was working on the first Arliss, and they offered me that job. But those characters are already established and so different that – and I grew up reading Tom Clancy, you know, in law enforcement. In 1984 is when The Hunt for Red October came out, and I was in the police academy. So they're all so different that keeping them separate is not hard. And I don't write them at the same time. I'm writing the bones of one while I might be writing a synopsis for the other one, you know, sending it off. But I focus on one at a time.
And one thing folks don't know, but I'll share it because this is American Warrior Radio. You're not just old school when it comes to your weapons. You're old school when it comes to writing. I mean, fountain pens, brother.
Yeah, I got one. Got my fountain pen in my hand right now, taking notes while we talk. And I just find that the brain works a little bit differently when you're unplugged. And so I do a lot of my synopsis and first drafts and stuff with pencils and fountain pens. Plus, I find that I can write anywhere. I mean, if I'm on a beach sitting on a, my wife does a lot of snorkeling, and I'll sit on the beach and work, and I don't particularly want to take my $1,200 computer and sit out there for, you know, 6 hours, 6 days a week, where I'm not averse to taking a pen or pencil out there.
Yeah, sand and computers don't usually mix.
They do not.
So inspiration for your stories, Mark, I'm guessing a lot of it comes from your experiences, but then also what you're still seeing out there in the current world. That, you know, you mentioned Tom Clancy, the John Clark character in that series that you were writing, has a point where he goes into the very dark and disturbing world of child trafficking. We had a real-life Jack Ryan on the show a while ago. His name is Nick McKinley. He's the co-founder and executive director of the Deliver Fund, a former Air Force PJ and CIA. Are you familiar with them and what they do?
Yes, I am.
Okay, there's probably some good stories there. I mean, interesting. I mean, the stuff they do is almost like out of a novel.
No, and I'm good friends with Derek Prestridge. I think he's a major now with the Texas Department of Public Safety. He and his folks started the Interdiction for Protection of Children, along with Michael Burke with the Marshall Service, our lead psychologist, kind of a forensic psychologist that helps hunt down different personality types, that sort of thing. And so I was interviewing them for my very first Jack Ryan and called Power and Empire, and that puts Clark back as an older man face to face with some of the things he faced in Without Remorse, and kind of reintroduces him as a grandfather dealing with the same sort of human trafficking stuff. So,
Mark, when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit of shop with you. Folks, you can learn more, visit markcameronbooks.com, M-A-R-C. CameronBooks.com. The question, the pending question on everyone's mind, Mark, that you can answer when we come back is, do you really switch seat cushions when you get on a plane? Stick around, folks. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with retired U.S. Chief Deputy Marshal. Did I get that right, Mark?
Say that again? Sorry.
Well, your title, when you were Chief Deputy Marshal?
Correct.
Okay. I always have to get edumacated because I'm just a radio host.
No, that's common.
Broadcasting out of my parents' basement, Mark. So,
folks,
you can find out more. Just a prolific writer, best-selling writer. You can find out more. Visit markcameronbooks.com, M-A-R-C, cameronbooks.com. Mark, I want to talk a little bit real world and talk a little shop with you because our listeners love that, and I figure it's a good educational component. One of the more intriguing guests other than you that we've had on the show is a fellow by the name of Greg Schaefer. He's a former FBI agent, and he wrote a book called Stay Safe, Security Secrets for Today's Dangerous World. And, I mean, it's a practical how-to manual that I encourage everybody out there to get and read. I mean, you know, basic stuff's how to get out of flex cuffs or, you know, what happens if you're to avoid getting kidnapped and things like that. I was joking about, I saw an interview where you switch seat cushions on a plane and tell us why, but you also confess that your whole career you were armed everywhere you went, including traveling on airplanes, and now you can't do that anymore.
Yeah, it's a different, you know, I've kind of come to grips with it now after being retired for almost 9 years, but I, you know, and I'm a guy that still carries. My son is a police officer. I have many of my friends are in law enforcement. So we, you know, I still carry. But at the same time, when I talk to people about safety and the things that Mr. Schaefer is talking about, it's kind of like martial arts where you have to, somebody's teaching you, for instance, how to get out of a choke and they make you, you know, stand there and you got to do it this way. That's not the way life works. It happens like a car wreck. Attacks happen. They just come out of nowhere. And so my opinion and what I tell people about safety and what I've incorporated in myself as a tactical grandpa, if you will, is it's not so much about the gun. The gun's and knives and all that. They're a tool. The weapon is us, and we need to be aware. And so I've just kind of tried to, as a granddad, tried to hone my awareness skills because I travel and, you know, where – places where I don't necessarily, where, like you said, on an airplane, but also in other countries I'm not packing. So I have to have something to protect myself and my family. And that simply put, is just being aware. And like Mr. Miyagi said in the Karate Kids, best defense, no be there. Sometimes it's better to just leave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess I'm not an expert, but to me, you know, if you could just communicate one message out there, it's situational awareness. And so
Absolutely.
Many of us, particularly in the cities, you know, we kind of go about our lives almost clueless about what's going on around us. And so often, you're right. I mean, you know, my wife makes fun of me because I'm one of those guys who likes to sit with his back to the corner. And you know, first thing I do is look around. Okay, what are the exits? What are we going to do if?
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of an interesting exercise, but. And God forbid I'll ever have to apply it, but it's a simple thing to do.
Absolutely. And even to take it a step further, we have basically turned over our brains to our cell phones, mm-hmm. and it does no good to sit with your back to the wall if we start surfing the Internet while we're in that same restaurant, because your brain is just plugged in. And you honestly don't hear how many people have been absorbed with whatever news or social media, and their partner had to say whatever they were going to say twice. Well, if you can't hear the one you love ask you a question, you think you're going to see the bad actor coming through the front door. So we walk around unaware all day, every day. I used to not let my kids go walk the dog or go walking with earphones in for their iPods. That's a lost battle now.
Mark, kind of a departure, but it made me think about that because I teased about the knucklehead who posted his picture on Twitter, holding mm-hmm. the gun that was used. What was the most knuckleheaded fugitive you ever apprehended, where you shook your head and said, "Man, life of crime is not for you"?
Oh gosh, I don't know. They're not. Most of the people we arrest are not particularly, James Bond villains that are super smart. The ones that are, I guess, stay out for a while. But, people that'll post pictures of their dog with the dog tag on it with their cell phone number on the dog tag, just people that post on social media that can't seem to stop themselves makes it pretty easy to hunt folks down. And honestly, I can't think of a boneheaded person we've had. I will say that I often get asked the opposite question: what's the most evil person I ever arrested or tracked down? And I would say that out of 30 years, I arrested a lot of people that did evil things, but probably only 10 or 12 that I would consider were evil, evil people. And of course, that's a judgment call, but people are people, and they're going to do boneheaded things and stupid things, and often we're seeing them at the dumbest time of their life. And, of course, as a dad of a police officer, boy, that's what I think about all the time. Who's mm-hmm. he going to – what intersecting path is he going to have tonight,
Well, Mark, we've only got about 3 minutes left, but I would like to get your opinion on that because I know – I'm a strong believer there is evil in the world, and sometimes out there when I see some of the policy that's being formed, it almost overlooks or is naive to that fact. What is your take on the current situation in our nation relative to our citizens and law enforcement?
We're lucky up here in Anchorage in that the citizens of Anchorage, by and large, have a good relationship with the police department and even the federal government. But I remember when my son, he's been on for a number of years now, he's on SWAT and all that, but I remember early on when he was just getting out of training and just, on field training and the first night that he was going off on his own, working mid shifts without a field training officer, I was a nervous wreck. I was just thinking, oh my gosh, there's so much bad out there. There's so much evil out there and terrible people. And even though I said I only arrested a handful, boy, they're out there and the evil ones are bad. And my wife was fine. She was kind of handling it and going about her business, and I said, "Sweetheart, how can you be this way? Our baby boy is out there on his own. How can you be so glib?" And she looked at me and kind of gave me one of those wan smiles and just said, "Mark, this is new to you. I've been dealing with this feeling for 30 years." And it really hit me that, I've sort of taken for granted what she's had to deal with when I was in the job. But I tell my son and I have this conversation all the time. If you want to go do another job, go do another job. I'll be just as proud of you. But if you're in it for the reason that we talked about in the beginning, then, you know, bow your head and keep doing it.
Good words. What would be your, Mark, you've said you've got the second best job in the world as a novelist. What would be your advice for other aspiring writers out there?
You know, I would say just write. Just take that time. Take the 15 minutes. I had a college professor that said you never amount to your full potential if you don't utilize those 15 minutes segments that other people waste. My biggest advice to everyone in the world is unplug from social media. I mean, it's fine to get out and connect with your friends, but do things. Err on the side of action. I think any one of my major characters says that at least once every other book. Err on the side of doing something. Unplug, go out. Now, I say that knowing that I've got to sit down behind a computer and write for 3 more hours after we talk. But go out, do things. You can, if you want to write, write.
Mark, 10 seconds. I don't want to be a tease. Why do you switch the cushions in an airplane?
Because the middle ones don't get set on as much, so they're not as beaten down. So I like to sit on the aisle. I can switch them and get a padded seat and aisle.
There you go, folks. Life lessons. Mark, thank you so much for spending time with our American Warrior Radio listeners. Folks, learn more. Visit Mark Cameron Books, M-A-R-C. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, you can find over 250 podcasts at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. We're on all your favorite streaming platforms. Please spread the word. Until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.